It's WSB's Money Matters with Wes Moss. Certified financial planner and chief investment strategist from Atlantis Capital Investment Advisors. Wes talks to you about investing and saving for the future. Brought to you every Sunday by RBM of Atlanta Mercedes-Benz, Sandy Springs.
Good morning. Welcome back to Money Matters. So much to talk about today. And we've covered everything that you need to know about tariffs and steel tariffs and aluminum tariffs and what it really means for the economy and how it impacts stocks and whether I think it's going to be more bark than bite or not. And if you miss that, it's no big deal. Just go to the podcast on iTunes, Wes Moss Money Matters. You can hear all of it. It's awesome. It's great. And it was fun. Now we're going to move on, though. And we're going to talk to you. We're going to go to the phones and answer your financial questions. Again, today, I want to talk more about recreating this 4% rule study, which is the most, it's a terrible headline name because you're like, oh, 4% rule. It's really about what, how much money can you take out and never run out of money? That's what the 4% rule is all about. And we updated this for, and it's a very controversial and an important lever in financial planning. And it was recently questioned in the Wall Street Journal, as it's been questioned many times over the last decade or so. Every time either stocks do badly or bonds do badly or inflation starts to peak up, which are the big levers in this study, some academic will come out and say, oh, you can't take more than 3%. So we went back and redid the 4% study, and they updated it with 25 plus years of new data from the original study. And really, our team at CIA, we used a much more conservative average estimate for future returns, because you have to do that if you're going to go out 50 years. And I want to go through what we learned about that. I'm going to do that today, but I also want to continue to go to the phone and take your calls and questions. So if you have a question about your retirement plan, whether you're a teacher with a 403B, or you're a government employee with some sort of thrift savings plan, or a teacher with TRS is what I meant to say, teacher retirement system or a 403B, or you're a government employee that uses the TSP plan, thrift savings plan, or maybe you just have a question about your own company's retirement plan, then happy to talk about that. There's an awful lot in the news about steel and aluminum and guns, for that matter, and those are surrounding publicly traded companies. What's inside of your mutual fund or your exchange-traded fund or the index that you own? Do you have questions about that? Have you and your family started thinking about, hey, we're getting ready to retire, but the numbers might not totally work. What are some other levers we can pull? A big part of our mission here is to help people get to a point where they can financially have the freedom to be able to call it quits at work. I can't tell you how many conversations over the years where people are just drained from what they do. You might have loved your job for two decades, but after decade number three, come on. You know, is it still as exciting as it used to be? After a 45-minute commute, and maybe it's an hour and a half each way, depending on the crazy traffic that we have in this town, one of the worst on the planet, by the way. We have a top 10 traffic problem, not in America, in the world. It weighs on you as a human. And there's only so many podcasts you can listen to. Sure, you can get your tire sooner than you think on audio CD. Great. Listen to it in the car. But it's going to make you even more want to stop doing the commute. So I get that. And we're very intent on trying to help folks figure out a way to be able to stop the commute. So anyway, all of that is what we come in here on Sunday mornings. It's the fun part of the show. It's the best part of the show. Your calls and questions. Phone lines open. And we'll continue to take calls today. 404-872-0750. Again, 404-872-0750 here in the studio, or 1-800-WSB-TALK. We're going to go to, I guess it's Guy in Douglasville. Good morning. Welcome to the show. How can I help?
What's up, Wes? How you doing, man?
Good.
I'm heavily invested in energy. Like, my oil stocks are getting crushed right now, but I recently got into uranium because I was told that they're building a lot of nuclear power plants in China and here in the United States. But they're not.
Well, I wouldn't say a lot. I mean, these things take like a decade or so. They don't just pop 20 of them up.
Yeah, that's why I'm buying it now when it's cheap, because I know in the future.
So what are you buying when it comes to uranium? What are you buying?
FCX, Camco, Denison Mines, a couple of different ones. I got about five or six of them.
Okay. Okay. So you're buying the big mining company. So FCX, Freeport Mac, and they're going to mine for tons of different. They're pulling a whole lot of stuff out of the ground.
Yeah,
I think from a broader perspective, it's okay to get some exposure there. Take a look at the S&P 500 for a second. If you look at it, you'll see that even though you would think mining is a giant part of the economy, it's only the materials sector within the Standard & Poor's 500, it's like 2.5%. It's a pretty small sliver. It's not insignificant. There's a lot of industries, obviously, in America, so no one industry has that huge of a chunk anyway. But you're talking about a pretty significant or pretty myopic piece of the economy. There is a, and this is a story I know very well, a hedge fund manager that, again, this is a story that I know relatively, I'm not going to say I know the guy, but you can probably read about this. There's a story of a hedge fund manager, very successful, doing really, really well, and got really heavily involved in not just mining, but individual mines. Hey, we buy this thing for X amount, or we can go in and do some financing, and all of a sudden, we've got, you know, the lion's share of everything they pull out of the ground, and all of a sudden we're going to quintuple our money because we have control of the rare earth metals that are coming out of the ground, right? Sounds like a great deal, but it's super capital intensive. You've got to think about how expensive it is to run an operation like this and then filtrate out exactly what you're looking for and figure out where you're finding all this stuff. And it becomes really expensive. So it actually becomes a very risky proposition. And you're dealing with an industry that can kind of be a home run if it works out, or you can get hit pretty hard. So I look at this and I say, look, yes, over time, you want exposure or broad exposure to mining. You want broad exposure to the material sector in America or around the world. And I'd say the answer to that is yes. But I'd be really careful. I've seen some of the smartest investors on the planet get burned by trying to get too specific when it comes to a particular piece of element or one sliver of the material sector. So if brilliant money, which is the hedge fund industry, at least it's supposed to be, can get burned, so can you. So I just want you to be really careful before you get too myopic in one of these pieces of the equation and get too hunkered down when it comes to investing. So get much more broad, and if I were you, I'd be careful about owning this sector. Brad joins us from Atlanta. Brad, good morning. Welcome to Money Matters. What's going on? How can I help?
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I'm trying to build an income portfolio like I've heard you recommend. And I'm wondering how much of that portfolio should be in MLPs. Is this a good time to buy them? And if so, which one?
Yeah, so here's a couple of thoughts. The MLP sector, it's been tough. It really has been a tough sector from a price perspective. And what happened is you go back about 5 or 6 years, or let's go back even a little further than that, as energy prices were booming. Remember when oil was going to go to 100 and then gas was going to go to $5 a gallon, and now oil wasn't just going to go to 100, but it was going to go to 150. And that was the talk of the day. We used to do show after show about energy because every analyst on the planet said, hey, oil's never going down again. Well, that obviously didn't happen. And oil prices, during that run-up, MLP companies, which are supposed to be really simple businesses, Brad, they're supposed to be, look, really simple. We're going to build, 10,000 miles of pipe here, and it's going to take oil or some sort of fossil fuel from one state all the way down through five states to a refinery so that we can refine it and move it from another get it in another form. And it's a pretty simple business. You build the infrastructure, you borrow the money to do it, you know what contracts are going to be, you charge, 50 different companies, you get these long-term 5, 6, 10-year contracts to move the fossil fuel through the pipe, and effectively, you run a toll business, which can be a pretty simple and pretty good business. The MLPs got really greedy, Brad, and they started to go from pipelines to and pipelines and storage to exploration and production and putting up their own wells and their own operations for this. And that's a really cyclical business. If you do that, it's great if oil is at 20 and you're an E&P and it goes to 100. It's terrible when you all of a sudden set up an operation when oil's at 100 and then it goes back to $25 a barrel. And remember, it wasn't that long ago that happened. And that's why you see these MLP companies get so burned and prices get hit so significantly. So they went through a period of time, let's call it a couple years ago, where they got, let's call it, a lot of religion. And they got out of the cyclical businesses that they shouldn't have been in to begin with when they got burned for. And they're back to becoming just these toll road operations again. So they've cleaned up their balance sheets. They have cleaned up their business models to go back to a more simple, straightforward business. And a lot of them have actually been able to maintain their dividends pretty significantly. There are a few that have cut. You've heard some fairly high profile cuts like Kinder Morgan. But a lot of these companies have actually maintained their dividends really well. Because there's still a lot of risk within the space, Brad, there are a couple that I own in broad terms. I own two different ETFs or ETNs. One of them is MLPI, which is a pretty broad, that tracks a broad range of pipeline and energy companies. And the other one is EMLP that I own that has, again, pipeline companies, but also some of the utility companies that are tangential to energy. Are a little more energy focused. So to me, that's the safest way to play it. It's still a really risky space. It still produces a lot of income, 3, 4, 5, all the way up to 7% a year for some of these MLP companies. I choose to play it with a couple of these broader ETFs, EMLP and MLPI are two of the or ETFs and ETNs. That to me is the safest way to play a fairly risky space. You're listening to Money Matters. I'm your host, Wes Moss, here every Sunday morning. Ryan Ely here to take your calls and your questions, producer of Money Matters. The phone line here, 404-872-0750 on this beautiful Sunday morning. It's just going to get nicer and nicer all day. Again, give us a call, 404-872-0750, 1-800-WSB-TALK. You're listening to Money Matters right here, News 95.5, AM 750, WSB.
Now back to Wes Moss of the money and investing advice you need.
Good morning. Welcome back to Money Matters. Wes Moss here every Sunday morning to take your calls and your questions. It's 53 degrees on Peachtree. It is, I would say, looking beautiful today. I don't know if it's like a mellish 10, maybe a mellish 9 at least, but exciting. Nice day today. So good morning. Welcome to Money Matters. We've been talking about steel and tariffs and taking your calls and questions. Again, 404-872-0750 in the studio. I want to go back to, though, this the 4% rule study. And again, why this is so massively important is that if you look at all the levers in financial planning, you can assume how fast your money grows. You can assume how much you save. You can, of course, assume how much you spend. But what trumps all of those numbers is how much you withdraw. So the withdrawal, how much do you need to pull every single year from your retirement money? That is the most critical piece of the equation. And many years ago, what became standard in our industry or in the financial planning industry was the 4% rule. William Bengen, MIT, very smart guy. But the study ended, he published it in 1994 with data up to 1992. So our team redid all of his same numbers, and then we extended it out another 25 years because we have a lot more data today than we did when we did the study. Time is on our side. So we came up with some interesting conclusions for that. We've been talking about this the last couple of weeks, but I have new developments in analyzing that data. So stay tuned for more Money Matters right here, News 95.5 AM 750 WSB.
It's WSB's Money Matters with Wes Moss. Certified financial planner and chief investment strategist from Atlantis Capital Investment Advisors. Wes talks to you about investing and saving for the future. Brought to you every Sunday by RBM of Atlanta, Mercedes-Benz, Sandy Springs.
Good morning. Welcome back to you. Money Matters. As our team here recreates the 4% withdrawal study with new conclusions. So I've said we're going to go into this. We're doing it right now, updated with 25 years of data from the original Bengen study while using more conservative average estimates for future returns. Okay, so we've talked about this in the past. This is the 4% rule, which if I'll quickly remind you what the 4% rule says. The 4% rule, if you want to look at it in a quick nutshell, let's boil it down to this. You can take 4% of your initial retirement money and to do round numbers, $1 million, 4% is $40,000. So $40,000 is just, that's your initial withdrawal. Then you take that dollar figure, $40,000, plus inflation over the course of time. That's the withdrawal metric here. And Bengen basically says that as long as you have at least 50% in the equity side of the equation and 50% on the bond side of the equation, and there's some leeway in those percentages, but as long as you have at least that much in equities, over time, your worst case scenario, your money lasts 35 years or so. And you've got to rebalance every year. So you start with four, you ratchet it every, that amount of money, then you ratchet that up every year for inflation. That is what this study basically boiled down to. Now, we wanted to update that because it was published in 94 with data up to 92. So I wanted to recreate this completely. And so there's a tremendous amount of new data, obviously, to add to this. Bengen's actual market data. So he used stocks and bonds and inflation. That's the data, went to 92. We added 25 years of actual data before moving to our own more conservative market-based assumptions in years post-2017. Of course, we only have data until last year. If we're going to say you retire in 2000, we're trying to get 50 years of retirement without running out of money. You got to get out to the year 2050, right? So you've got to make some assumptions once actual data stopped, and which is exactly what Bengen did. So our results in recreating all of Bengen's original work produced, I would say, very similar results or conclusions. Now there are two really important inflection points. And these inflection points are in the percentage rate of withdrawal needed to satisfy that $40,000 or whatever the initial 4% was. So $40,000 plus inflation every year. So these are a couple really important inflection points that investors need to be aware of. I refer to these now as these withdrawal rate inflection points as the Buffett zone and the danger zone. Immediately makes me think of Top Gun. Immediately makes me think of Top Gun. So we use data from Bloomberg and we use data from the Stern School of Business, so at NYU, Stern School of Business, on historical market returns for the S&P 500 and then the total return for the 10-year Treasury bond. Now, there was a slight difference in our base data set. It's a little bit different numbers and again, when you do these really long-term multi-decade studies, a percentage point or half a percentage point can certainly make a difference. But just for kind of full disclosure, the Bengen study, and then we could only match up to where he ended, his S&P 500 or stock number was 10.3%. His bond number was 5.2%. Remember, this is average annual. Bonds, 5.2%. Inflation averaged a full 3%. In his model. Our model, similar, but our data is just a little bit different. Came from Bloomberg and the Stern at NYU. Our S&P 500 number was 10.8%, the bond side 4.8, and inflation 3.4. So the stock data that we used was slightly higher by 0.5%. The bond data that we used was lower by 0.4%, and then the inflation rate was higher by 0.4% as well, because we used 3.4 versus 3. At least that was the average number. Now, I don't know exactly why, even though, of course, we have new data, new years, even compared to his data, things are a little bit different. This may be due to how new data is reported versus when he got data back from Ibbotson, is where Bengen got his data. or something may have changed in the reporting over the last 25 years, or maybe we may be using a slightly different type of inflation data or bond index than Bengen. But his appendix is a little unclear exactly where he got where we're getting this variation. But again, the assumptions are very, very similar. And as a result, our data set using slightly lower bond returns and higher inflation returns, which again, the withdrawal scenarios we use were actually slightly more punitive. Even though stocks are a little bit higher, the real killer in this is inflation. Hence, our study compared to Bengen's, there was a slightly higher percentage of years when retirement funds, quote, ran out. We're trying to figure out years to run out, question, in quotes. So our study, beginning withdrawal year, every year from 1929 to 09, with actual market data until 2017. After 2017, we assumed average stock returns of 5%, bond returns of 1 or 2%, and a range of inflation scenarios. So 50% S&P 500, 50% 10-year Treasury bond, and then CPI-U data from the Bureau of Labor Statistics, found on Bloomberg. Portfolio value $1 million. Initial withdrawal was 4% or 40,000. Then we take each year thereafter, 40,000 adjusted for whatever inflation was. 82 separate starting points. 82 separate years when withdrawals began. All right, here's the data and our recreation of the study. 51 out of 82 scenarios, money lasted at least 50 years or in a lot of cases, just perpetuity. So 62% of the time, you sailed in retirement, take 4% of your initial value, ratcheted up every year for inflation, and still had tons of money left over. In 31 out of 82 scenarios, money did run out. So 38% of the time. In the scenarios where money ran out before 50 years, the quickest drawdown to zero happened in 29 years. So the worst case scenario in our recreated study was still nearly three decades. Your money still lasted almost 30 years. Bengen's was 35 at his worst case scenario. And again, that's because our data that we used was actually a little bit more punitive. It was a little more harsh. It was a harsher environment. So here are these two zones. Though, here's what I really get out of this. And I want you to remember, this is big time stuff. This is super critical stuff. So forward this to your friends and any of your folks that are thinking about retirement. There's two really interesting points here that you've got to remember. One is called the Buffett zone. The next one is the danger zone. Here's the Buffett zone. If your annual withdrawal rates ever dropped below the 2% level, the portfolio growth often became exponential. And then your withdrawal rates plummeted due to the if you think about it this mathematically, once you have the portfolio value grows, it can more easily support that initial what is a percentage, but it really becomes a hard dollar figure. It's 4% for whatever inflation is. So as your portfolio grows and you have a couple good, for example, let me give you an example. If you started withdrawing money in 1950, your 4% was 40 grand. That turned into an under 2% withdrawal rate. You only needed 2% of your portfolio by 1963 to support that same amount of money plus inflation, whatever it inflated to. Because markets in the early years of your withdrawal benefited from really strong market returns and relatively benign inflation. So for 1950, for the next 3 years, if you started right out of the gate, the S&P was up over 30%, over 23%, over 18% 3 years in a row. So if you retired in 1950, and this is where the numbers get crazy, and I double check this, but if you retired in 1950 and use all of our metrics, $1 million portfolio would have turned into, drum roll, in the year 2009, your $1 million is still, after taking out money all these years, still turned into $51 million. And then by 2017, it turned into $100 million. Again, sounds crazy, but when you get into these giant numbers, compounding is compounding. It's just math. So the key here is that $40,000 plus inflation became, or in this scenario, becomes or can become either can become really easy to support if the portfolio has a long and early stretch of outsized performance. Then you get into the Buffett zone. That's how guys like Buffett became multi-billionaires, is that big numbers started to compound upon themselves and they became massive numbers. Now, here's the scarier piece of the equation. There's good news here and there's bad news. The bad news is there is a danger zone. So on the contrary to the Buffett zone, once your $40,000 plus inflation, that's your need here, requires a 6% portfolio withdrawal rate, due to a significant drop in portfolio value or a significant rise in inflation-adjusted withdrawals, again, in the early years, then these portfolios become doomed to run out. So, and this is exactly what happened for scenarios that began in 1965 and 1966. Those are the two worst years to retire, where money ran out, or where run out occurred in year 29. A lot of it has to do, and again, this is just the math of compounding, whether it's positive or negative, in this case, negative. Much of the damage came in the extremely high inflation years during the 1970s. So in the early years of withdrawing funds, market returns were poor and inflation was high. So you kind of had this double whammy, creating this mathematical environment where withdrawal rate percentages had the amount that you needed on a percentage basis to support your 40,000 plus inflation had to really spike higher. So once withdrawal rates go beyond 6% a year, it becomes really difficult for those rates ever to recede back to more normal or sustainable levels. And then the portfolio assets quickly enter the danger zone. So the bottom line here is that the 4% rule, which is 4% in your initial year, then that dollar figure plus inflation still works the majority of the time. The Buffett zone, that's achieved once withdrawal rates drop to 2%, and very often your portfolio just becomes exponentially powerful to support that, and it tails higher. And then the danger zone is reached once withdrawal rates top 6%, and it almost craters lower. So withdrawing money from your portfolio it's not a static game, though, and this is what this really tells us. Investors have to be willing to adapt to market environments and be able to modify their spending. This is the dynamic approach to withdrawing funds that's critical to your portfolio's survival. That's the key here. You know, Ryan Neely's waving to me. Yes, Ryan. Yeah, we have a prize pack. I almost forgot. Ryan, what's going on with the prize pack?
The WSB Weekend Prize Pack is a family 4-pack of tickets to an Atlanta Gladiators home game at Infinite Energy Arena and a Kroger $50 gift card. This week's trivia question, it is March, which means it's March Madness. UNC is the defending national champion. Of course, Wes, I know you're happy about that. Can you tell me, who did UNC beat last year in the championship game?
I know who UNC did not beat last night, and that would be the Blue Devils. Anyway, good morning. Welcome to Money Matters. We're going to quick news, weather, traffic, or, yeah, News 95.5, AM 750, WSB.
Now here's more great money and investment advice from certified financial planner Wes Moss.
Good morning. Welcome back to Money Matters. There we go. Some Top Gun music. We talk about the Buffett zone and the danger zone. Make sure you know the difference between the two. Kevin joins us from Dunwoody. Kevin, good morning. Welcome to the show. What's going on? How can I help?
Yeah, I've got 200 shares of Boeing stock that I bought for $120. And it's obviously improved significantly in price. And Fidelity keeps telling me to sell some of it because it's over 10% of my portfolio. They say the price could go to even, you know, $400 to $500. Should I sell some now? Should I keep it? If it gets to that price point, do you think it'll drop dramatically? Or,
well, listen,
what's your advice?
Yeah, it's a tough one because it's been such an amazing stock. I mean, if you look back over the last year, it's up around 90% over the past 12 months, and the Dow, it's a member of the Dow, it's almost single-handedly carried the Dow. Or it's one of the very best performers. It's really helped the Dow. It's $344 today. So here's the rule of thumb. We've all heard this. You're not supposed to have more than 10% of any one stock in your portfolio. You've heard that ad nauseum. What's interesting about that is that I've seen a lot of people build wealth significantly by totally ignoring that rule. you know, I've seen folks that have had a little bit of stock that started to do well, and they just held it and held it and held it, and it's literally made them a fortune. And that is, I've seen that play out. It's one of the few ways I've seen people become really, really wealthy. You know, if you think about a Home Depot or a Boeing over the years. In your case here, how old are you?
70.
70. And how much are you relying on this money to for retirement? I mean, you've got 200 shares of this, 200 shares at three. You could have told me this, but times 344, you've got 70 grand worth of Boeing stock, and it's 15% of the portfolio. That means you've got about $450,000, right, in the account?
Yeah, right.
So, you know, again, I'd say you're at your upper limit. I don't have a perfect crystal ball on a stock like Boeing, because it's kind of, it's almost in no man's land. It's, you know, trading at 25 times earnings, so it's a little highly valued, but it's also in a wonderful sector. Sure. I would say that to try to be on the side of prudence, I would probably say at 70, I'm relying on this money, I'd trim it back to 10. That's me. I'd trim it back to 10, but I wouldn't sell it completely. That's my answer to when you're overweighted in a particular company, and this happens to be a pretty good one. That's at least what I would do. All right. Thank you for tuning in. Again, you can find the podcast on iTunes, Wes Moss, WESMOSS. Money Matters. You can find the book at retiresoonerbook.com. That's retiresoonerbook.com. Have a wonderful rest of the Sunday, and stay tuned to the best programming on the planet right here, News 95.5 and AM 750 WSB.